Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a terrorism expert shares his thoughts on the crisis in Syria. We get differing views from an Iran nuclear debate. Our cyber guy talks about blurring the line between crime and espionage.
Really, the only way to defend against this is better intelligence.
And we'll hear about Lady Antebellum taking a break from the road. It's right here on The Voice of America. While the waves of refugees continue to press onto Europe, there are some who say the best way to deal with the situation is to both stop the Syrian civil war and stop Islamic State. Looking at that question is International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. I posed that question to Lane Begg, an associate fellow at Chatham House and a professor at the London School of Economics. He says that solution won't take place overnight or anytime soon.
It's unrealistic at the moment because we've been witnessing these difficulties, not just in Syria, but also in Eritrea since 2009. And I don't see an easy solution to this coming rapidly. Certainly, it's part of an overall solution. For Europe, dealing with the external source of the migrants is as important as dealing with the humanitarian tide that has crossed the Mediterranean over the last few months. But it isn't going to happen quickly.
What would you set forth as recommendations for Europe to do to address the problem at the source, the Syrian civil war and the Islamic State?
Well, they can only do this in collaboration with other countries in the international community. It will take U.S. influence. We also know that the Russians have been holding up the Syrian regime, and they've been reluctant to intervene. Turkey has its own doubts because of its conflict with the Kurds. So all of this is politically complicated. What Europe can do is exert pressure. It can provide political support for those that are trying to resolve the conflict. But I think we have to be clear on this. It will not happen soon enough to deal with the refugee problem that we face today.
How well prepared is the UK and the rest of Europe to take a flood of refugees, not just for a little while, but again and again and again, possibly for several years?
Well, the Europeans have been struggling to find a way of coping with this. The European Union is not a strong federal entity like the US federal government. It's an organization which is very much the sum of its individual countries. And many countries in Europe, for different reasons, are opposed to being generous towards immigrants. There's also a confusion in many European citizens' minds between immigrants who are refugees and therefore fleeing conflict and those who simply want to come to Europe to get a better life. Europe has not been able to find a formula to deal with this, which is the reason we see these images of confusion over the last couple of weeks. I think there will be a huge amount of pressure coming, particularly from the Germans, to share out the burden of coping with the migrants and not leaving it to the frontline countries, which are Italy, Greece, and Hungary. There will also be an enormous pressure on the police authorities across Europe, including the European equivalent of Interpol, Europol, to find a way of cracking down on the people smugglers who are causing so much misery.
That was Lane Begg, associate fellow at Chatham House and a professor at the London School of Economics.
Solving that Syrian conflict would really make a huge difference in that region and in Europe.
And if it were solved, Susan, the Islamic State wouldn't have such favorable conditions.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey, for that report.
Thank you, Susan.
Both the United States and the NATO alliance have expressed growing concern over a Russian military presence in Syria. My colleague Victor Beatty is following that story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, a senior U.S. defense official told VOA that Russia has been airlifting military supplies to Syria and described the activity as unhelpful. U.S. spokesman John Kirby Wednesday said the development prompted Secretary of State John Kerry to speak with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
He reiterated our concern about these reports of Russian military activities or buildup, if you will, in Syria, and made very clear our view that that if true and if borne out, those reports could lead to greater violence and more, even more instability in Syria. And we're not helpful at all to what eventually the international community should be trying to to achieve inside Syria.
Meanwhile, in Prague Wednesday, NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg expressed similar concern.
That will not contribute to solve the conflict. I think it's important to now support all efforts to find a political solution to the conflict in Syria, and we support very much the efforts by the UN to try to find a political solution to the conflict in Syria.
A Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman said Wednesday Russian military experts are in Syria to help its military make better use of Russian weaponry and other equipment. She says the terrorist threat in the country and in Iraq has reached unprecedented heights. Reuters reports that by declining to clarify the extent of its military presence, Moscow keeps the West guessing in order to win a stronger bargaining position when world powers finally sit down to talk about how to end the nearly five-year-old conflict in Syria. I spoke with terrorism expert Greg Barton about the possible scenario that would keep President Bashar al-Assad, a Russian ally, in power in a rump Syria.
The Assad regime controls probably less than a quarter of Syria. Its final default position may be to fall back on running a mini rump state with the backing of Russia. And in some ways, as a transitional solution, that's not necessarily a bad thing. The priority at the moment has to be dealing with ending the civil war and the threat of Islamic State. So looking at a compromised transitional solution, which will need some cooperation from Russia, counterintuitive as that seems, actually could be very welcome. So whilst it would be better not to have this complication, it's not necessarily ultimately going to be a problem to seeking a solution.
The United States' position has been that Russia's intervention militarily would only complicate matters, prolong the conflict, and risk confrontation.
It has the potential to do all those three things, but it's not automatic that it will. If Russia is taking a realist position, recognizing that Assad's never going to regain control of the Syrian territory he's lost, and if Russia recognizes that Assad is now a very difficult ally to support because of the brutality he's used against his own citizens, but they're part of a compromise solution for a rump state, a transitional state, leaving the Assad regime in Damascus, then that may be the best of all possible outcomes in the short term. I mean, the priority has to be both dealing with Islamic State and al-Qaeda groups like Nusra, but also ending the civil war. The civil war just eats up lives with every passing month, and anything within reason that can and bring this conflict to a halt or limit its extent is got to be welcome at this point. And, of course, this is part of the backstory to the refugee crisis.
And Greg Barton says he sees the conclusion of Iran nuclear talks in a comprehensive agreement as paving the way for growing Iranian involvement to resolve the Syrian conflict. On Tuesday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani indicated that Tehran was ready to hold talks with the U.S. on ways to resolve Syria's civil war.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Andrew Palchevsky has joined me here at the Anchor Desk, and he's always snooping around about what's going on in social media. Andrew, what's up today?
Well, we've been talking for the past week and a half about the European refugee crisis and how social media is playing such a big part of that.
Right.
And it's how people are communicating back home to family, communicating, trying to find a path to Europe. And now we have Doug Johnson here at Voice of America, who's one of our digital reporters, writing about how health and emergency professionals are now using these apps to try to get aid to these people. So it's another good application of that. So a great article on voanews.com. I encourage everybody to check that
and
out.
And I tweeted that out earlier this morning, this story.
So you can
story,
find so it on International Edition as well. And I know you're on Twitter as well, so you can find it there. And quickly, because we have a short little segment today, the Apple event we talked about yesterday.
Yes, how'd it go?
The big news is the Apple Pencil. It's a pencil that you can use on the new iPad.
Like a stylus. Releasing,
like a stylus. And it costs $99. So people are saying, I'm not spending $99 for a stylus. Other people saying they're releasing the Apple Pencil. I can't wait for the Apple Pager. So a bit of a dud maybe for Apple, but we'll see what happens when the products come out.
I would use my regular pen.
Yeah, I'm sure. I don't know. They probably have something where you can't do that. They're probably proprietary stylus or whatever.
No doubt they think of anything. Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Have you ever wondered what happens to rain or snow once it falls to Earth? Researchers analyzed hydrogen measurements taken by NASA's Aura satellite to track the flow of water after a rain or snowfall. Among the researchers' key findings are that the world's plants may not be using as much water as was previously estimated. Also revealed in the findings is that water from precipitation penetrates soil faster than previously thought. of the precipitation that reaches Earth, the researchers found that more than 25% of it runs off the land and flows directly into the ocean. A good portion of the remaining 75% of the non-runoff water is released by plants during photosynthesis, and the rest is evaporated back into the atmosphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. Senate Democrats have secured 42 votes in support of the nuclear deal with Iran, one more vote than needed to block any potential disapproval vote in the Senate. The 42 votes in the Senate mean that President Obama is not likely to have to use his presidential veto to ensure that he can implement the international deal with Iran starting September 17th. However, supporters and opponents of the deal are still airing their arguments for their positions. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy followed a debate at the Brookings Institution between Republican Senator John McCain and former National Security Senior Advisor Bruce Rydell. And Mohammed joins me here. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Okay, well, what was the basic concern that dominated the debate?
Well, so apparently the Obama administration succeeded in explaining the strong verification mechanisms the agreement with Iran entails, because the debate focused mostly on the non-nuclear aspects of the deal. For example, Senator McCain aired his concerns about the impact of the agreement on Iran's behavior in the region.
They're in control in four countries at least, in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. Recently, they're giving weapons to the Taliban in Afghanistan. They're still the world's single most important sponsor of terrorism. They're on the move. And they're not relenting, nor has there been any indication whatsoever of a change in their behavior.
Senator McCain said that lifting the sanctions will enable Iran to use tens of billions of dollars in pursuing its ambitions in the region.
Well, even the Obama administration is worried about that. Is there any strategy to curtail Iran's destabilizing activities?
Actually, Bruce Rydell acknowledged that the Middle East is in flames and that the Iranian regime is aspiring to expand its influence in the region. However, he said it's better to have a deal that keeps Iran from becoming a nuclear power.
I have no illusions about the Iranians. I know what they are going to do with additional money. It is still better to find a path to keep them from developing nuclear weapons. I think the challenge for the United States, we need to figure out ways we can bolster our allies' capability to deal with the other threats Iran poses after this agreement is put into place, particularly the terrorism, subversion, and political evil that Iran is likely to be up to.
One important note, Sue, that emerged from the debate was a statement from Senator McCain acknowledging that the upcoming vote in Congress will be based on party lines and that not a single Republican senator will vote in favor of the agreement with Iran.
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for summing up the debate.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, hackers blurring a cyber line and a Grammy-winning trio wanting to spend time with family. ...2015 may well go down as the year that computer hacking went mainstream. Whether at the White House or retailers or corporate giants, computer network security professionals are scrambling just to fix the thousands of hacks that have already happened, let alone prevent any new attacks. And now, security professionals are confronting a new challenge, namely the blurring of the lines between cyber crime and espionage. International Edition Cyber Guy, Doug Bernard, joins us. And welcome, Doug, as always.
Great to be here.
Thank you. What exactly is the line between crime and espionage online?
Well, traditionally, cyber criminals, usually organized crime, very often from European nations, were looking for immediate financial gain. So, for example, they would target a retailer like Target and steal millions and millions of credit cards and try and, you know, steal as much money as they can before people figured it out and shut it off. So it's very simple and very basic. And it hurts millions of people kind of on an immediate, low-impact sort of way. Espionage is one nation state trying to learn the secrets of another nation state. So, for example, hackers potentially from China, it hasn't really been established yet, stealing millions and millions of documents, personnel records with private details of government employees. That is clearly an effort to gain data that's not immediately useful, but could have use down the line, maybe blackmailing somebody or turning somebody or putting together a spear phishing campaign. So it, one thing was one thing and the other thing was the other. But we're entering this new era now where the lines have become a lot fuzzier. Say, for example, last year's targeting of Anthem Insurance, over 70 million personal insurance records were stolen. Now, there's all kinds of, again, personal private information in there. But is that for a criminal? Is there criminal use for that? Is there potential espionage use for that? It's really quite unclear, and we're seeing a growing trend of agencies and organizations being targeted for unclear reasons.
Is it going to get more and more unclear in these cases?
I think so, and a lot of and the cyber professionals that I was speaking with worry that it is. They usually break the world down into two kind of categories. There's information and there's intelligence. Information is somebody running in and saying, oh my gosh, we're being hacked, we're being hacked. Intelligence is looking at where the hack was coming from, who might be behind it, learning who was targeting you and why, so you can better defend, you know, your systems in the future. What's happening as these lines get blurry is we seem to be awash in information, but the intelligence is becoming a lot fuzzier. So the cybersecurity professionals really don't know. You can only build so many firewalls to protect your system.
You can only change your password so many times.
That's exactly right. And so they really say they need to know who is targeting us and why. And both criminals and, it looks like now, nation-state actors are intentionally trying to smudge those lines to make it more difficult.
Well, how can you get through those smudges?
Really, the only way to defend against this is better intelligence.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug, for stopping by.
You bet.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A state-of-the-art simulator that uses gaming technology to simulate various driving situations. Australian researchers designed what looks like a large exercise machine with a steering wheel surrounded by huge video walls. The video walls show various traffic frustrations, including tailgaters, roadworks, and rude, abusive motorists. It's designed to test road rage. Here's researcher Paul Turner.
All of us have been oblivious and distracted and occasionally probably even aggressive when we didn't need to be. What this study will be about is giving us some lessons as to what makes us act that way, why do we act the way we do when we're driving, and then what can we do about it.
And our road rage personalities are not good for our health, says fellow researcher Bertie Scott Parker.
And we know that increased levels of stress can have really bad health outcomes like heart disease, problems associated with cancer and diabetes.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
Multiple Grammy-winning trio Lady Antebellum is finishing its Wheels Up tour, and the band has decided to take some time off. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about the move, which will allow the band to spend time with their families and allow them to work on a new song for a Broadway show.
Nikki, this is not unpredictable because two of the three band members have children.
Yes.
And one is expecting their first child.
Yes.
But, you know, Lady A is like a huge act in country music.
They are. They are humongous. And Hillary Scott explained this is not a breakup. This is just a break. And that they have been going nonstop since like 2007. With their first release. And they have been, they've released like six albums, so it's almost been like an album a year. So she said, even though they're very accomplished, they've had a great run, all three of them are ready to just enter the next season spending time with their families. They want to give themselves the gift of time. And so they're going to take some time off. And hiatus is what they're calling it. Not a breakup. Not necessarily a break.
Hillary had a baby last year, was it? 2 years ago.
Baby is 2 years.
So the baby's a couple of years old.
Yeah.
And those are years you don't get back.
Yeah,
particularly if you're a mom.
Exactly.
You know, and one of the guys in Lady A is expecting his first child with his wife.
Exactly, that's Charles Kelly.
Yeah, and so...
And Dave Hayward also has a little one.
Dave Hayward has a little one, and that's tough. It can be very, very tough. I mean, granted... When you are a platinum-selling country artist, you have a very nice tour bus. But it's not home.
Doesn't compare, no.
It's not, you know, it's not home. It's not your own sheets. You know, it's not getting up and going to the kitchen and getting coffee in the morning or playing in the yard. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, we've got to go from here to here and unpack and do sound check and maybe grab a couple of minutes with the kids and then go do a three-hour show.
Or, like, do a home-cooked meal or, you know... Say, hey, let's all hang out at the house, not necessarily the tour bus. So let your heart, sweetheart, be your compass when you're lost, and you should follow it wherever it may go. When it's all said and done, you can walk instead of run, 'cause no matter what, you'll never be alone, never be alone. But this is, as you said, it's not going to be a complete break.
They plan to do some songwriting while they're taking some time off, too.
Yes. Apparently, they're going to be part of the SpongeBob musical, which will hit Broadway next year.
SpongeBob being a cartoon character on Nickelodeon. Yes. He is literally a sponge in blue pants who lives underneath the sea.
Exactly.
In a pineapple.
Yes. And considering that, you know, they all have little ones... It'll be perfect for them. And so they're supposed to be contributing a song to the musical. I don't know if it's going to be an original song. I'm assuming it is, that they're going to create it.
All right. Well, if you want to send a tweet to Nikki, you can send it to @VOA_music. And you can also listen for her and Country Hits USA on our website. That's voanews.com.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the United States, it was called the Underground Railroad, the network of people and safe houses used to help black slaves in the 19th century escape bondage in the South. Recently, a documentary filmmaker traveled to Iraq and learned the story of a 21st century network of people who are risking their lives to help free Yazidi women and girls who have been enslaved by Daesh. The filmmaker, Edward Watts, spoke of the bravery of the individuals engaged in the rescue operations, as well as the level of depravity experienced by the young women who have been captured. Women and girls from minority groups like the Yazidis suffer unspeakable depredations at the hands of Daesh: torture, gang rape, slavery, imprisonment, and in some cases, murder. They are bartered and sold naked at markets, offered up as incentives for Daesh recruits and rewards for fighters. And Daesh boasts about such atrocities, ignominiously claiming that because these women are not Muslims, Daesh fighters are religiously justified in their behavior. But it is not only women from religious minorities who are suffering under Daesh's reign of terror. Muslim women and girls are as well. In its most recent Trafficking in Persons report, the State Department notes that Daesh forces local girls and women under its control into marriages with its fighters and kills them if they refuse. In a CNN interview last year with a Syrian female defector from Daesh, the 25-year-old woman said, "The foreign fighters are very brutal with women, even the ones they marry. There were cases where the wife had to be taken to the emergency ward because of the violence, the sexual violence." The defector, identified only as Khadija for her protection, said that she agreed to be interviewed because she wants to warn people, especially women, who, like herself, are lured to join Daesh through its online propaganda. "I don't want anyone else to be duped by them. Too many girls think they are the right Islam," she said. Daesh As Zainab Bangura, United Nations Special Representative on Sexual Violence in Conflict, has said, has institutionalized sexual violence and the brutalization of women as a central aspect of their ideology and operations. Such brutalization is a blow to human dignity and to the very foundation of civilized society. It destroys entire communities and makes stabilization efforts all the more difficult. And it is a key reason why the United States and its partners remain determined to defeat Daesh.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.